Good Morning Pensacola. Andrew McKay and the Pensacola Morning News starts right now.
Good morning, 710 here on News Radio 92.3, informative, local, dependable. I'm Andrew McKay. It's Pensacola Morning News. Here in Pensacola, everything is pretty much normal. We're going to get up to about 70 degrees today. But, of course, all eyes in the entire nation are focused on D.C. this morning, thinking about Wichita, Kansas, the families connected to the U.S. figure skating program, the Russian figure skaters, and the 60 people plus the crew of four look like they have perished in this plane crash where it ran into a Black Hawk helicopter being flown on a training mission by three members of the United States Army in D.C., and it looks like they are saying that, you know, everybody was killed, which is unfortunately awfully what we thought might be the case, and turns out that that's what they're saying, that they are in recovery now, not in rescue. Somebody who knows quite a bit about this terrain, this space, this concept, the former commanding officer of NAS Whiting Field, retired Navy Captain Matt Coughlin, who is now the director of the Pensacola International Airport and himself was an H-60 pilot for the Navy, so flew this exact same platform, the Navy's version, just not the Army version. Matt, welcome back to the Pensacola Morning News, sir. I wish it were under better circumstances.
Yeah, exactly. A horrible day. Thanks, Andrew, for having me.
Of course. So I just wanted to, you know, look, I know that the investigation here is going to take a long time, but I wanted, first of all, just to ask you, you know, you've seen, I'm sure, this horrific video of what happened. You probably have been, you know, talking with people, and you certainly have thoughts. Anything you want to tell us, you know, from what you've observed so far about this incident that took place in D.C.?
Sure. Like any, you know, aviation mishap, we talk a lot about the Swiss cheese model. And when you line up all the holes in the Swiss cheese, those being either causal factors or contributing factors, and you can put a pencil through that cheese, they all line up, and then that results in a mishap. In this particular case, like every case, there's going to be a lot of different contributing factors to what happened. They'll go as far back. They'll look at pilot and air crew histories, you know, what they did for the last 36 hours. They will go so far in depth on investigating this. But at the end of the day, they'll come out with what the anomaly was and really what caused the accident. As for that area up there, you know, this isn't out of the normal type operations up there. So something was amiss. Questions I would have, and these are probably helicopter perspective questions, is for the air crew, were they wearing night vision goggles? Were they goggled up? Because that impacts, potentially impacts their visual sight in peripheral, in both in color and depth perception. Were they on goggles? What altitude were they cleared for? Were they flying the VF, what we call a visual flight route corridor? Did they exceed any of those parameters?
Can I pause you there for just a second, Matt? Just because I know it's a term that's it's such second nature to you, but for people who may not know, can you just explain to them the difference between flying, you know, visual flight versus instrument flight, or just explain that because that's a term that may become relevant here, and it's useful for them to understand.
Sure. So there's basically two ways you fly, both either under instrument flight rules or visual flight rules. And visual flight rules are usually during what they call visual meteorological conditions, meaning the weather is good enough where you don't have to strictly fly off your instruments. It's all done visually. So I'm sure, you know, basically there's a VFR corridor, a visual flight rule corridor, through that area that the helicopter was probably flying through. And really, he was probably in contact with the tower. I don't know for the CRJ aircraft, whether they were instrument or visual. But the bottom line is weather conditions at the time were pretty clear. So they were both in and out of the cockpit visually. So how that impacted them, I don't know.
You were kind of in the middle of explaining some of the things you had thoughts about, and I kind of interrupted you just to make sure that was clear to folks. But You know, as you say, the everything's it's strange so far. One of the strange things about this is the fact that there's no obvious reason why this would happen, right? They're both, it's clear, they're both on normal flight patterns. You know, I assume they're both responding to the tower and the airspace. There's one Airbus, you tell me if I'm wrong, that's going to be directing both the Army helicopter and the civilian flight, right?
Correct. At that point, so close to the airport, both, I'm sure, were talking to the air traffic control tower. You know, for the CRJ coming in, they get transferred over to the tower at a certain point, but I'm sure being that close, they were already cleared to land, so they were in communications with the tower, just like the helicopter.
You know, one of the things that I really wanted to have you on to talk about is because the immediate thing that I was thinking of is, you know, layman's perspective is that, you know, civilian flights, commercial air travel, and military are two very different worlds. But in a shared airspace, there's got to be a way to keep them interacting safely, which is something that we know a lot of, or you know a lot about, obviously, here in Pensacola. And I want to talk a little bit about that. Back to Matt Coughlin, the airport director for Pensacola International Airport and also the former commanding officer at NES Whiting Field and himself, a Navy version of this same helicopter platform in the Army. They call it a Black Hawk. In the Navy, they call it a, you know, a Seahawk, or the Air Force, it's a Pavehawk. Like, everybody uses this platform. Talk to me a little bit about that question of how you keep the civilian and the military interacting safely, because we have so much of this, right? You know, you've got the trainers from NES Whiting Field. You got the trainers from NES Pensacola. You've got inbound and outbound transiting. I mean, we get helicopters all the time. Cobras and Seahawks come in all the time and go out, and, you know, F-18s and all kinds of stuff. How does that all work in one shared airspace?
Well, you bring up a great point. We do have very busy airspace here, given all the entities that fly around here. You know, Whiting themselves, the training wings up there, they do about 1.2 million operations a year, which is huge. So there is a lot of activity here. So how do you mitigate that? You do that through, you know, for instance, we, the airport here at Pensacola, have a letter of agreement with the FAA, and how they do their local operations here. To keep that all separated, at the end of the day, they're the ones controlling the airspace, and they're real good at it. And as long as they keep everything inside the parameters of the LOA, their procedures, everything's good to go. And, you know, just history would show it becomes a very safe environment and evolution for anyone that flies in and out of here. It is busy, but again, everything's looked at, everything's mitigated, and everything's committed to, you know, policy and procedures. So we've been very fortunate. It doesn't go without risk. There's certainly risk out there, but we do everything in our power to mitigate that.
I assume, again, you tell me if I'm wrong, that the plane, for example, I mean, the plane wouldn't have the ability to talk to the helicopter. The helicopter, had they known the plane was coming, wouldn't necessarily have the ability to talk to the plane. They're talking through air traffic control all the time, right? And I also assume that the helicopter is able to communicate with, for example, Fort Bavoir, I think is the name of the fort that they came from. But they're having, you know, conversations with more than just air traffic control. But you tell me, is that all basically right?
That's possible, but that's such a close location to the airport there. Everyone's on the same frequency.
Okay.
So they have that awareness. Now, they may not be talking directly to each other because that causes problems in itself. So
sure.
They are, like you said, talking through the tower, but it is a monitored frequency, and instructions are given on that frequency. But the leader, or the one in charge there, is the tower.
Would it be normal or abnormal for the helicopter to be operating with its exterior lights on in a situation like this, or can you even say? Because that was my first thought, is on a clear day, even if it's at night, and maybe especially at night, that helicopter should be super easy to see for the plane. But again, these are the thoughts a civilian has. What do you think?
Sure, and that'll all come out in the mishap report, but... They, you know, the short video I saw, they did have some lights on. Now, mm-hmm. They'll have strobes. And So, yeah, I mean,
oh, you're right, from the video. That's right. Yeah, you're right about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's entirely possible that the helicopter was positioned in such a way that the plane was coming at them from a visual blind spot behind or obscured by some equipment that, you know, there's a lot of helicopter between the pilot and a lot of space behind them. And so it's difficult to see, right? It's difficult to know. And even if they did see at the speeds of a helicopter versus an airplane, not much to be done, even if they saw something, right?
Well, you bring up a great point. I mean, there's an aspect there of which directions they were heading in and what their line of sight and their visibility was at the time. That's why I brought up the question of whether they were on goggles or not,
yeah,
because that can impact peripheral vision. And so what was their field of view? And and the big thing is, what altitude were they at? You know, they're cleared a certain altitude or parameter to fly at. What was the altitude of because these are safety mitigations that are put in place, assigned altitudes. And so what were the altitudes of that aircraft coming in, and what was the altitude of the helo, and did either one of them exceed that?
One of the, and I know it's very early to speculate, but I was watching NBC this morning and they had somebody on who thought that maybe, if you've seen the video, there's a plane in sort of front field of view in the top. And then there's in a little bit the distance, there's the 60. And then you, of course, see the other plane come in and you see the collision. He said that he thought maybe the helicopter was either directed to or working to avoid the plane that we're seeing close to us in the top. And that making sure they were clear of that one, maybe weren't focused on whatever else might be a threat in the vicinity. I don't know whether that's plausible or not, but I just figure in an airspace like this, there's so much going on that you kind of have to just put your life and your flight in the hands of the air traffic controller.
Yeah, I'd hate to speculate, but we're talking about the same one, the bright lights in the very beginning, mm-hmm, kind of closest to the camera, those look like an aircraft that's actually departed, has already taken off and has departed in the area. And then what you see between the interaction between the landing aircraft and the helicopter, physically, if you look at a map, it's probably pretty far away. You know, that could be up to a mile or two away.
Okay. Distances can be deceptive. Well, Matt Coughlin, I wanted to give you sort of a last ability to comment on anything I didn't ask. Anything else you think about this incident, or, you know, maybe just kind of reassure people that, you know, this is stuff that you guys deal with all the time, and especially in this very busy, military and civilian airspace in Pensacola, what people should be thinking about, you know, airline safety in general.
Sure. I mean, it's a very, it could be complicated, but everything, like I said, the risks are mitigated. It's a very safe environment, just based on the history itself. We have a very safe record here, and, so I think that's comforting to know. Also, I would put out for folks to think about the first responders up there, because that's some pretty arduous conditions that they're operating in and trying to, whether it's trying to recover or early on in the evolution, pull off some rescues. But that's a dangerous evolution in itself, so keep them in mind.
Absolutely.
Also.
Yeah, no, 300 people out there in those temperatures. Hey, John Pickens, who's a kind of an aviation enthusiast, is my producer. He wanted to ask a question. Do you know whether the Blackhawks have the TCAS, the traffic collision avoidance system, on board? Do you know whether that's something that they use?
You know, that would be hard for me to speculate. I don't know what version of aircraft it is, and I'm not even familiar with the Army version. They all have their different suites of avionics, so hard to say or hard to speculate on that.
Sure, and that's kind of what I figured, because it's, you know, each one is a little bit different than, for example, the one you flew for the Navy. Matt Coughlin, thank you so much for the time. Thanks for doing what you do. Thanks for every day keeping air travel so safe here in Pensacola, you know, and with your vast experience on this. I really appreciate it, and thanks for giving me so much time this morning to help our folks kind of think about this and understand the situation, sir. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks, Andrew. Have a great day.